pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that a lot of folks forget when they start listing the great fighters of the Second World War. Everybody remembers the Mustang. Everybody remembers the Spitfire. Long, graceful, thoroughbred lines. And they earned it. But there was another one, fatter, heavier, homelier, if we're being honest. An airplane, a mechanic, once called a milk jug, with a propeller, and the name stuck. They called her the Jug. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and today on the hangar we're going to talk about the Republic P-47 Thunderbolt. The biggest, heaviest, most stubbornly hard-to-kill single-engine fighter America put into the sky in that war. Stick with me, because the story of how this airplane came to be, and the things it brought its pilots home from, is one of the great ones. Before we get into it, a quick word about the folks keeping the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. And if you know a pilot who just knocked out a rating, there's no better handshake than a coin that says somebody noticed. All right, let's go back to the beginning. In the late 1930s, there was a company on Long Island called Republic Aviation. Before that, it was Seversky, and it had a brilliant, hard-headed designer named Alexander Carvelli, Georgian immigrant, came up through the French aviation world, and he thought about airplanes differently than most. And Carvelli had a problem to solve. The Army Air Corps wanted a high-altitude fighter. They wanted it to fly high because that's where the bombers were going to be flying and that's where the fighting was going to happen. 25, 30,000 feet up in the thin, cold air where a normal engine just runs out of breath. Now to make an engine breathe up there, you need a turbocharger. A big one. And here's where it gets interesting. Carvelli didn't start his design with the wings or the cockpit. The story goes that he started with the ductwork. He drew the turbocharger system first, this enormous plumbing job that ran the exhaust gases all the way back behind the pilot to a turbo mounted down in the belly, then fed the compressed air all the way forward again to the engine. That's a lot of pipe. That's a lot of airplane wrapped around a lot of pipe. And the engine hanging on the front was a monster in its own right. The Pratt & Whitney R2800 Double Wasp. 18 cylinders in two rows, right around 2,000 horsepower. To turn all that power into thrust, you needed an enormous propeller, a paddle-bladed thing more than 12 feet across, and a prop that big means long landing gear to keep the blades off the runway, which means the wings have to sit up high enough to fold that gear away. You see what's happening? Every problem Carvelli solved created the next one, and the airplane just kept getting bigger. When they finally rolled it out, the Thunderbolt weighed in loaded at around 8 tons. 8 tons for a single-engine fighter in an era when a lot of fighters weighed half that. Pilots coming out of little trainers climbed up into this thing, and it was a long climb, and they must have wondered what on earth they were about to fly. Let me put you in that cockpit for a second. You're sitting high, way up over that huge round nose, and you can't see a thing straight ahead on the ground, so you're S-turning down the taxiway just to know what's in front of you. The canopy on the early ones is a framed birdcage. You push the throttle up and that Double Wasp doesn't so much roar as it thunders. This deep, chest-rattling drum of 18 big cylinders and the whole airframe leans into it. The takeoff roll is long, longer than you'd like. She does not leap off the ground. She gathers herself and she goes. But then you climb, and you keep climbing, and up high where the thin air chokes everything else, that turbocharger is still stuffing sea-level pressure into the engine, and the Jug comes alive. 30,000 feet and she's happy as can be. Now here's where it gets interesting. And here's where this airplane earned the love its pilots had for it. Early on, the Thunderbolt had a problem. It couldn't turn tight with the nimble little German fighters down low, and it climbed like it was carrying a piano. Some folks in the Air Force wondered if they'd built the wrong airplane. The first missions over Europe in 1943 were rough. It didn't have the legs to escort the bombers deep into Germany, and the enemy figured out that if a Thunderbolt got on your tail, you could sometimes just dive away and outturn him near the ground. But the pilots who flew her started to figure out what she was good at, and what she was good at was two things nobody could match. The first was the dive. 8 tons pointed straight down with 2,000 horsepower pulling. Nothing in the sky could dive with a Thunderbolt. If a Jug driver got above you and rolled in, you were not going to escape by going down, because he'd catch you and blow right past. Pilots learned to fight in the vertical, slash down, hit hard, and use that tremendous energy to zoom right back up out of reach. Boom and zoom, they called it. The Jug was built for it. The second thing was the one that made grown men climb out of that cockpit and pat the cowling like it was a horse that carried them home. The Thunderbolt could take a beating that would have killed anything else. That big radial engine up front, air-cooled, no radiator, no coolant lines, full of glycol running through the airframe like the liquid-cooled Mustangs and Spitfires had. You put a single bullet through a Merlin's cooling system, and that engine will seize before you get home. But an air-cooled radial? You could shoot cylinders clean off the front of a double Wasp, and it would keep hammering away on the ones that were left, coughing and shaking, but running. Running long enough to get a scared young man back across the channel. The stories are almost hard to believe. There was a pilot named Robert Johnson, one of the top American aces in Europe, and early in his tour he got bounced, caught by a German fighter that put cannon shells and machine gun fire all through his Thunderbolt. His engine was hit, his canopy was shattered, his controls were half shot away, hydraulic fluid and oil all over the windscreen so he could barely see. He was bleeding from shrapnel in his face and hands, and then a German pilot pulled up alongside him, looked him over, and dropped back in behind to finish the job. He emptied his guns into Johnson's airplane. Johnson said later he could hear the bullets hitting, this steady drumming into the armor behind his seat, into the fuselage walking up and down the airplane. The German fired until he was out of ammunition. Then he pulled up alongside again and looked at this shot-to-pieces American who somehow was still flying. And he shook his head and he waved and he flew home. Because he could not shoot the thing down, Johnson brought that Thunderbolt back to England. They counted the holes, more than 100, some say a good many, more than that, cannon and machine gun both, and she flew him home. That was the airplane. That was the jug. Now let me tell you what she did with the second half of the war, because this is the part that mattered most, and it's the part folks forget. Once the Mustang showed up with the range to take the bombers all the way to Berlin and back, the Thunderbolt got handed a different job. And it turned out to be the job she was born for. Ground attack, they hung bombs under those big wings. They hung rockets, and she already carried 8 50-caliber machine guns, 4 in each wing, a wall of lead. And they sent the Thunderbolts down low, into the dirt, to tear apart everything the enemy tried to move. After the Normandy invasion, the Jugs owned the daylight over France. If it moved on a road in occupied Europe, a Thunderbolt could find it and kill it. Locomotives, trucks, tanks, trains, fuel depots, whole German columns learned they could not travel in the daytime because the sky belonged to those big paddle-bladed fighters coming down out of the sun. And this is exactly where all that ruggedness paid off double. Because ground attack is the most dangerous flying there is. You're down low in the muck, right in the teeth of every gun on the ground. Small arms, flak, everything shooting up at you. The liquid-cooled fighters were terribly vulnerable down there. One rifle bullet in the wrong line and you were done. But the Jug soaked it up, came home riddled, came home with pieces missing, came home when she had no business coming home. And every mechanic who patched her, and every pilot who walked away from her knew exactly what that air-cooled engine and that armor plate, and that 8 tons of Republic steel had bought them. More Thunderbolts were built than any other American fighter of the war, more than 15,000 of them. They flew in Europe. In the Pacific, in the China-Burma-India theater. Everywhere the fighting was, the Jug was there, doing the dirty, dangerous, unglamorous work. And I think that's why she got forgotten a little. The Mustang got the glory of the long escort missions and the pretty lines, but the Thunderbolt did the hard labor down in the weeds, and she brought her people home. There's a nobility in that a magazine cover never quite captures. Here's something to sit with. If you go to a warbird show today, a fly-in, an air museum, you'll see Mustangs. There are a fair number still flying, but airworthy Thunderbolts? You can very nearly count them on your fingers. There are only a handful left in the whole world that still take to the sky, so if you ever get the chance to stand next to one, to hear that double Wasp light off and clatter into a roar, to watch 8 tons of Republic iron come around the pattern, you stop what you're doing, you take your hat off. Because you're looking at something the world will not make again. Run your hand along the leading edge of that wing, and think about the men who took her down into the flak, and the one she carried home with cylinders, shot away in 100 holes in her hide. Back when I was coming up, the old-timers who'd flown her didn't call her beautiful. They didn't call her graceful. They called her something better. They called her the airplane that got them back. Now, I leaned on the accounts of the pilots themselves for a lot of this, Robert Johnson's own telling of that day chief among them, along with the records of Republic Aviation and the standard histories of the Army Air Forces in the war. Credit where it's due to the men who wrote it down, so we could still tell it. If you want to see photos of the ones still flying, or find out where a Thunderbolt's kept near you, come find us at radiohangar.com. That's the Jug, homely, heavy, and beloved by every man she ever brought home. Not a bad thing to be remembered for. I'm Taildragger. Keep the blue side up, and I'll see you next time.